Here is the Cannabis Bee News with your host, Joe Jameson.
Hello, my listeners. How are you doing today? This is episode CBN 019, 227, 2013. Start with article number one, Weeding Through Marijuana Facts and Fiction by Dr. Glenn D. Brunstein, MD, Vice President of Clinical Innovations at Cedars-Sinai. Take it away.
Weeding Through Marijuana Facts and Fiction. Glenn D. Brunstein, MD, Vice President of Clinical Innovation at Cedars-Sinai. Source, HuffingtonPost.com. In Colorado and Washington, adults now can legally unwind after a tough day at the office by lighting up a joint. Meanwhile, here in California, 17 other states and the District of Columbia, anyone complaining of nearly any ailment, from migraines to menstrual cramps, can seek a prescription for medical marijuana and fill it at a local dispensary, of which there are an estimated 1,000 in Los Angeles. Voters' push to loosen marijuana laws reflects widespread public opinion that pot is both beneficial in treating medical conditions and poses little, if any, risk. Is this an accurate perception or a pipe dream? Marijuana, aka weed, grass, pot, cannabis, is typically a product of the dried flowers, leaves, stems and seeds of the cannabis sativa plant. It has been used medically and recreationally throughout the world for somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 years. Many believe Chinese Emperor Shennong was the first to prescribe it, in 2700 BC. By the 1800s, marijuana, along with other plant-based remedies, made its way west and into the black leather bags of American physicians, who prescribed the herb for various problems ranging from insomnia to sexual dysfunction. Today, pot is the most widely used illicit substance in the world. An estimated 119 million to 224 million people across the globe used cannabis in 2010. In the United States, more than 18 million people older than 12, roughly 7% of the population, reported having used marijuana within the past month in 2011. Despite this long history, we have far less clinical evidence about marijuana's effects than many other, newer drugs. That's largely because it's illegal in most countries. In the United States, pot, like heroin and LSD, is classified as a Schedule I drug. This designation, which appellate courts as recently as January 25 declined to alter, means that, despite state laws, according to the federal government, it has no approved medicinal use and possesses a high potential for abuse. The only authorized source of marijuana for research is grown at the University of Mississippi and is controlled by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which favors studying potential risks rather than benefits of cannabis. Cannabis's illegal status also makes it difficult to find funding for research. Still, some medical benefits have credibly been demonstrated. Marijuana is effective in managing chronic pain, which afflicts about 100 million Americans. It can improve appetite in AIDS patients and can treat nausea and vomiting in cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy. As for other conditions that marijuana has been touted to treat, like epilepsy and multiple sclerosis, clinical proof is still meager and inconclusive. Pot was once considered a boon for glaucoma patients, but the Glaucoma Foundation does not recommend its use because while it can reduce pressure in sufferers' eyes, relief lasts only 3 to 4 hours. Meaningful help would require multiple doses a day, and since marijuana affects blood pressure, it is possible that it could make glaucoma worse. Risks commonly associated, though not necessarily caused by marijuana, like its trigger effect for schizophrenia, cognitive decline, and a connection with testicular cancer, aren't entirely understood either. Among the most convincing findings for marijuana as medicine is a 2007 study at San Francisco General Hospital, in which marijuana helped relieve peripheral neuropathic pain in HIV patients. Neuropathy, which can be caused by a variety of disorders including cancer chemotherapy, is a debilitating, burning sensation of the hands and feet. This is the condition outspoken Los Angeles City Councilman Bill Rosendahl told the Los Angeles Times he uses marijuana for. In the San Francisco General study, 25 patients smoked 3 marijuana joints a day over a 5-day period and reported a 34% reduction in pain. By comparison, the 25 patients who received placebo cigarettes, which looked and smelled like marijuana but without the active ingredient, THC short for delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol, reported only a 17% reduction. Another study at the same hospital, conducted in 2011, found that the addition of marijuana reduced pain for patients already being treated with opioid drugs. When 21 patients taking either long-acting morphine or OxyContin twice a day added inhaled marijuana via a vaporizer to their regime, pain was decreased by an average of 27%. The marijuana did not significantly alter the blood levels of the prescription drugs. This finding might prove helpful in combating the current epidemic of opiate overdoses in our country. Pot therapy has limitations, though. Marijuana contains more than 480 chemicals, 66 of which are cannabinoids. These interact with receptors in different parts of the brain that control just about everything, including pleasure, memory, thinking, concentration, movement, coordination, and sensory and time perception. These receptors are abundant and complex. Activation for one purpose can spark other undesired effects. The properties that reduce pain, for example, are entwined with those that elicit mind-altering effects. That may not be a deterrent for someone terminally ill with cancer. But a construction worker with a pinched nerve isn't going to want to operate a forklift while high. In addition to relieving pain and eliciting the euphoric high feeling that attracts recreational users, marijuana can increase heart rate, appetite, and sensory perception, diminish coordination and cause short-term memory loss, anxiety, paranoia, and sometimes even psychotic episodes. Most people smoke pot rather than ingest it in food like brownies or tea, because the effects are immediate. Marijuana contains many of the same toxins as tobacco, but does not appear to diminish lung function the way cigarette smoking does, possibly because marijuana smokers tend to smoke less. In a recent, long-term study of more than 5,000 participants, moderate users, those smoking up to a joint a day for 7 years, showed no decline in lung function. There were too few heavy users, those smoking two or more joints a day, in study to evaluate effects among that group. The study did not investigate other lung issues, like cancer or chronic bronchitis. Mental illness, especially schizophrenia, has long been linked with marijuana use. Many studies suggest that smoking pot, especially in adolescence when the brain is still developing, can trigger schizophrenia in people predisposed to the illness, as well as worsening symptoms in those already diagnosed. But this adds to a persistent conundrum. The prevalence of schizophrenia has remained at about 1% of the population, while marijuana use has increased exponentially over the past 6 decades. More recently, researchers have suggested a link between chronic pot use and a decline in intelligence. Last year, a team of international researchers reported observing an 8-point IQ decline among chronic marijuana users who had begun using in early adolescence. Researchers studied more than 1,000 New Zealanders, who were tested at ages 13 and again at 38. The drop was found among participants who said they had become dependent on the drug by age 18. Critics point out that the decline could be due to participants' socioeconomic factors, such as income and education, that contribute to their adolescent marijuana use. Either way, teens in this country don't appear too concerned. Marijuana use among high school students is at a 30-year high. Some 6.5% of high school seniors smoke marijuana daily, while 23% report having smoked it in the previous month, according to the most recent annual survey funded by the National Institute of Drug Abuse. The report also showed continued popularity for synthetic pot, which is made from herbs and chemicals and mimics pot's intoxicating effects. Marketed under names like Spice and K2, synthetic marijuana could be purchased legally until recently. Experts debate whether marijuana is a gateway drug that leads to more serious substance use. However, there's a general consensus that it is addictive for about 9% of users, versus 32% for nicotine, 17% for cocaine, and 15% for alcohol. More alarming, some 19% of teens report having driven stoned, According to a recent survey by Liberty Mutual Insurance and SADD Students Against Destructive Decisions, more than just teens drive while under pot influence, almost one in five motor vehicle deaths, U.S. auto safety regulators report, involved either cocaine or marijuana use. In a 1994 study of 175 motorists stopped by police in Tennessee for reckless driving, mean age 27, 68 tested positive for marijuana. In California, 7.4% of drivers were found to have marijuana in their system, according to a November survey conducted by the California Office of Traffic Safety. Driving within 3 hours of smoking marijuana puts you at nearly twice the risk of having an accident that leads to serious injury or death and being sober, according to a recent research review of nearly 50,000 drivers in several countries. One would assume that not getting behind the wheel shortly after toking is a no-brainer. Likewise, common sense suggests little good will come from excessive, chronic recreational marijuana use, or indulgence by adolescents and young adults, in the midst of sensitive brain development. However, occasional use by adults generally is unlikely to cause serious long-term health consequences. But users should be aware that, unregulated by an agency like the FDA, pot's purity and potency vary greatly. As for cannabis's medicinal potential, I strongly urge the federal government to heed the American Medical Association recommendation and review the drug's classification so more meaningful research can be undertaken. Classifying it as a Schedule II drug, similar to amphetamines and opiates, would go a long way toward moving the field along to better examine its benefits and risks, while still retaining control over its use as a medication. We need more science and less blather from blue noses and stoners both about a substance as potent as pot. It's neither a prudent nor productive analogy, at present, to compare marijuana to alcohol or tobacco and to conclude blithely that, as a matter of public policy, just because there are so many users, we should just turn an absolute blind eye. It also has not shifted the situation to call marijuana evil and advocate its elimination as part of a war with doubtful outcomes. We've grown wiser and more cautious in many ways about booze and cigarettes for significant, scientific health reasons. We should see marijuana in enlightened fashion, too, neither demonizing nor glorifying it and discussing its role in our lives and our society with eyes wide open and common sense in gear.
Well, that was a long-winded one, but it was a lot of great information. Let's roll into Article Number 2, Marijuana Legalization 101. Humboldt State University Research Institute to host lecture on pot money. Take it away, B.
Marijuana Legalization 101 HSU Research Institute to host lecture on pot money. Kasipur. Source, The Times Standard. With California marijuana activists gearing up for another legalization push following the successful November elections in Colorado and Washington, one local banker is continuing to explore the economic implications that marijuana legalization could have on Humboldt County. Jennifer Budwig, Redwood Capital Bank Vice President and Regional Area Manager, will discuss the topic at the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research's speaker series on the HSU campus on Tuesday. Her thesis for the Pacific Coast Banking School graduate program at the University of Washington found that the marijuana industry, based on conservative estimates, was responsible for pumping at least $400 million annually into Humboldt County's economy. If that money were to disappear, potentially due to legalization, it would cause a 25% reduction in local economic activity, Budwig concluded. Budwig said she will be updating the numbers to include more recent data for her presentation. She said she also plans to talk about the implications of not including legalization on the 2012 California ballot, and discuss what has transpired at the federal level on marijuana enforcement. Sociology professor Josh Meisel, who co-chairs the Marijuana Research Institute, said concerns about the economic impacts of legalization are ongoing. A recent article in The Economist estimates that the American marijuana market is worth $50 billion, Meisel said. If we consider Humboldt County as perhaps ground zero, we can afford to keep our heads in the sand. We need to consider what the potential ripple effects may be. with a movement afoot to see legalization back on the California ballot in 2016, he said Budwig's research is important for all Humboldt County residents to consider. Her study isn't about how legalization impacts those who work in the marijuana industry, Meisel said. It's about a community that very likely, and we don't have really hard data on this, stays afloat and prospers because of the influx of cash marijuana production and distribution creates. From business owners who have received large payments in cash to individuals who subsidize their income by working in the underground economy, Meisel said everyone has a story about the marijuana industry, and how it has affected them. I could imagine anyone believes the economic impacts are not significant and not important, he said. Greater Eureka Chamber of Commerce CEO J. Warren Hockaday agreed. Hockaday said Budwig, a former chamber board member, has given a presentation on the topic to the board. I found her work extremely well done, he said. By its nature, this industry is very hard to quantify. But any way you get your arms around it, you have to acknowledge it's here, it's going to stay, and it is a significant factor in our economy. Although the university has taken some flack for the Marijuana Research Institute, Hockaday said he finds it refreshing to approach the topic of marijuana from an academic perspective. There is just so much emotion caught up in the issue, he said. No matter how any individual feels about legalization or use, the fact is that there is a lot of money moving and changing hands and supporting the local economy in ways that nobody can ignore. For more information, contact Josh Meisel, Humboldt Institute for Marijuana Research Co-Director, at visit www.humboldt.edu.
Article number 3. CEO says hemp could pay huge dividends. Hope I have my money in the right place. Take it away, B.
CEO says hemp could pay huge dividends. By Ralph B. Davis. Civitas Media News Service. Source, HazardHerald.com. While much of the debate over whether to legalize industrial hemp centers around the crop's potential for a Kentucky agriculture industry that has been decimated by the fall of big tobacco, one area business leader says the big money lies in a different direction. Industrial hemp has been a hot topic of debate in both Frankfort and Washington, as the state Senate passed a bill to legalize the crop in Kentucky, 31-6. The bill faces an uncertain future as it heads to the House of Representatives, as House Speaker Greg Stumbel has publicly expressed reservations about it, telling the Lexington Herald leader earlier this month that the issue needs further study, because it is not certain the crop has a market. Meanwhile, in the nation's capital, U.S. Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell introduced a bill last week to legalize the plant nationwide. Hemp proponents extol its virtues as a means to recover some of the losses caused by the collapse of tobacco. In the 1990s, tobacco averaged over $800 million a year for Kentucky farmers, but that figure has been cut by more than half in recent years. Meanwhile, Kentucky has a historical legacy as a chief producer of hemp. When the crop was legal, Kentucky produced $5 million worth of the plant in 1850, the crop's peak production year in the state. That $5 million then would be worth more than $135 million today, when adjusted for inflation. But Roger Ford, chief executive officer of Patriot Bioenergy, in Pikeville, says both sides are missing the bigger picture. Nobody's talking about the energy aspect. While growing hemp can open up a new revenue stream for the state's struggling farmers, Ford said there is far more money to be made by creating value-added products by processing the crop in Kentucky. That's the key to this whole thing, Ford said. It's not about growing it and shipping it somewhere else. Ford says hemp could boost the lagging coal industry and help Kentucky become a self-sufficient energy producer through two avenues, biomass and biodiesel. By burning hemp fiber briquettes with coal, Ford says the local industry could benefit. The added hemp would result in overall lower emissions, giving longevity to the local market at a time when concerns over greenhouse gases are sapping demand. This could help coal by creating a locally produced product that could be blended, Ford said. We're not competing with coal. We're working to find ways to improve and make it more competitive. He says Patriot is currently conducting tests to determine the viability of using hemp as a biomass additive to coal, and he expects the results to be favorable. He said his company has also explored other crops, such as sugar beets and sorghum. While the beets would also be a good fit, he said, a low yield per acre makes sorghum not cost-effective. But the biomass aspect of hemp only takes into account the fiber from the stalk of the plant. Another attractive element of hemp, Ford says, is the oil from hemp seed, which he said could be used in the production of biodiesel. Ford cited a study by the Eastern Kentucky University Center for Renewable and Alternative Fuel Technologies, which showed that a single commercial biofinery producing 50 million gallons of biodiesel a year would mean $480 million and 2,000 jobs for the state's economy. A handful of those refineries, Ford said, could make the state a net producer of energy. While Ford says such a refinery could produce biodiesel using the oil from hemp or any other suitable plant, University of Connecticut researchers published a study in 2010 finding hemp a viable and even attractive feedstock for biodiesel production. Among hemp's strengths are its ability to grow like a weed in infertile soils without requiring a lot of water or fertilizer, as well as a high efficiency of conversion that allows 97% of hemp oil to be converted into biodiesel. The ability to take advantage of infertile soils creates another opportunity for hemp production to find a home within the coal industry, Ford said, because the plant could be grown as a means of reclaiming mined lands. Coal companies could find themselves extracting fossil fuels and growing a renewable energy source, using the same land. It creates a strategy not of competition, but of integration and diversification, Ford said. Read more. Hazard Herald KY CEO says hemp could pay huge dividends.
Article number 4. Bill to legalize marijuana in Maine attracts Democrats and Republicans. There it is, B. Take it away.
Bill to legalize marijuana in Maine attracts Democrats, Republicans. Christopher Cousins, Bangor Daily News. Source, theforecaster.net. The bill, sponsored by Republican Diane Russell, D. Portland, and co-sponsored by Republican Aaron Libby, R. Waterboro, would make vast changes in Maine's drug law, ranging from making possession of up to 2.5 ounces of pot legal to imposing a tax of $50 per ounce. Russell and others argued during a news conference Thursday afternoon at the State House that laws against marijuana have enmeshed too many nonviolent offenders in the legal system and deprived government coffers of millions of dollars in revenue. Russell estimated that taxing and regulating marijuana could generate up to $13 million a year, three-quarters of which he proposes routing into the state's general fund, which supports the majority of state government including public education and most social services. The rest of the revenue would pay for implementation of the law, substance abuse treatment and prevention programs, and research on the effects of marijuana. We have retail establishments that grow and supply medical marijuana to responsible consumers, said Russell, whose first effort to legalize marijuana failed in the legislature 2 years ago. We have proven here in Maine that this can be done for medicinal purposes and it's now time to institute that same strict regulatory infrastructure for responsible adult recreational consumers. Russell proposes making it legal for individuals to grow as many as 6 plants if they are cultivated in a locked space. She also supports allowing the transfer of the drug from one adult to another without compensation, as long as they are at least 21 years old. The bill would make it illegal to smoke pot in public and calls on the Department of Administrative and Financial Services to license marijuana retail stores, cultivation facilities, product manufacturing facilities and testing facilities. Libby said his support for the bill isn't about promoting drug use, but rather about taking government regulation out of what he called a morality issue. I believe that ending marijuana prohibition is a true part of limited government, said Libby. As a fiscal conservative, I see great potential in the economic growth of removing these prohibitions. David Boyer, who is the Maine political director for a Washington, D.C.-based group called the Marijuana Policy Project, argued that in many ways marijuana is far less harmful than alcohol. Marijuana is objectively far less harmful than alcohol for the consumer and for the broader community, he said. It is irrational to punish adults who simply prefer to use the less harmful substance. Law enforcement resources should be focused on preventing and responding to serious crimes rather than enforcing the failed policy of marijuana prohibition. Denison Gallaudet, a former superintendent in the Richmond area, also supports the bill because of the potential revenue that could be reaped by the state. But another reason for his support of the bill is that in his experience, drug laws don't keep marijuana out of the hands of kids. We were confronted with the fact that our high school kids were smoking marijuana at twice the rate of smoking cigarettes, said Gallaudet of his time as superintendent. This is clearly a plan that is not working. If passed by the legislature, an act to tax and regulate marijuana would result in a statewide referendum in November 2014. Washington and Colorado approved ballot measures last year that legalized marijuana for recreational use. Bills to regulate and tax marijuana like alcohol also are expected to be debated this year in Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Vermont, according to the Marijuana Policy Project.
Article number 5. Ziggy Marley introduces organic hemp seed at the South Beach Wine Food Festival. Take it away, B.
Ziggy Marley introduces organic hemp seeds at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. By Lane Doss. Source, BrowardPalmBeach.com. Ziggy Marley comes from musical royalty. His parents are Bob and Rita Marley, who, with the Wailers, brought Jamaican reggae from the Kingston ghettos into the mainstream. Being the eldest son of musical icons has rubbed off on Ziggy. At age 44, he's already had a musical career spanning 3 decades, receiving 5 Grammy Awards in the process. Marley has also acted, most memorably portraying Ernie the Rasta Jellyfish in Shark Tale. And he has grown his family's Tough Grong label into a worldwide enterprise, created the Marijuana Man comic book, and is active in many charities. Marley is also passionate about advocating for the labeling of GMO products in our foods, and he's launched Ziggy Marley Organics, a line of products that are USDA certified organic, non-genetically modified, and kosher. The products include flavored coconut oils and hemp seeds. Marley combines his passion for music and food at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, where he's closing out the weekend's events at Guy Fieri's Reggae Jam with Ziggy Marley Live 6:30 p.m. Sunday, February 24th, at the Ritz-Carlton South Beach, $95. The Caribbean-themed evening will feature a full concert by Marley, and partygoers will have a chance to try the hemp seeds and coconut oil. We caught up with Marley, who spoke to us about how food and music play into his culture and lifestyle. How did the closing event concert with Guy Fieri come about? Ziggy Marley, we have the food line now, and I wanted to expose it to as many people as possible. To reach the people at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival is very special. What made you want to start an organic food line? I love good food, and it's been a big part of my culture growing up. I'm from Jamaica. We have very special foods there. I'm a food person, so when the idea arose, it was natural, really. I like healthy food. I know the difference between eating good and bad food because I've eaten both. When I eat well, I feel a life energy. After eating badly, I feel sluggish and lousy. So I'm conscious of this, especially when I'm performing and I'm on the road. Food is a very important part of that. That love and knowledge of it is very natural. How did you decide to start with coconut oil and hemp seeds? The two products are made from items that I know, coconut and hemp seeds. These things I know. It's not like I'm doing a ham, Ziggy Marley's ham. I don't eat ham, so I can do that. Are you vegan? I'm not vegan, but I would say I'm mostly vegetarian. It's good to be vegetarian. When I eat vegetarian, I feel very light and lively. I try to eat vegetarian most of the time, though sometimes I eat fish too. So we won't be seeing a sausage soon? Maybe a vegetarian version. You have 2 products now. Do you plan to grow Ziggy Marley Organics into something larger? For right now, I'm satisfied taking it easy and slow. Everything we do has to be thoughtful and appropriate with our lifestyle and philosophy. We're taking our time. This is something I'm comfortable with. It's a part of me. anything I do is going to be something that I'm close to. For instance, I grew up with coconuts. In Jamaica, we drink the water, eat the jelly, which is the meat inside, and we cook with it. We grew up eating this food. It's a part of our culture. This is natural, it's organic, GMO-free. Besides, if you don't want to eat it, you can put it on your skin, you can put it in your hair. It has multiple uses. Let's talk about the hemp seeds. Do you think that people are going to buy them because of Ziggy Marley and your lifestyle, which is connected with marijuana culture? Sure. Any way you want to take it. I have a comic, Marijuanaman, and my song Wild and Free is all about hemp. This is part of my circle. If people get turned on to hemp seeds because of my affiliation, that's fine with me. Because in the end, hemp seeds are really nutritious. They work well with our bodies. It's who I am, not just music and food. It's books and comics. I'm trying to express myself fully and truthfully. There are a lot of things in me that still have to come out. This is your first South Beach Wine and Food Festival. What are you looking forward to at the festival and while you're visiting Miami Beach? My grandmother used to live in Miami, and we used to visit her regularly. My brother used to play football for the University of Miami, so I love it here. I'd like to try some Cuban food while I'm here, maybe go to Quilaco. At the festival, I want to explore everything. I'm just getting introduced to the chefs and the food scene.
Let's roll into article number 6. Weed Country premieres on the Discovery Channel. I saw the first episode. I saw some good stuff in there, but I also saw some drama stuff in there. It's a little beyond. But it's a TV show. Hope they keep on showing them good stories. Good stories of healing people. All right, B, take it away.
Weed Country premieres on Discovery Channel. By Lisa King. Source, WashingtonTimes.com. February 20, 2013. If the success of a show like Moonshiners on Discovery Channel, it was just a matter of time before the network found pot farmers willing to share their similar lawless exploits with TV viewers. The result of their search airs tonight at 10 p.m. With cameras in tow, Weed Country goes deep within the Emerald Triangle, a region in Northern California well known for the quality and quantity of its marijuana. In part, Weed Country focuses on Siskiyou County, and a town within the county appropriately named Weed. Originally named after a timber tycoon, Weed, California is one of the many small towns in the Emerald Triangle that have taken the cultivation of marijuana to a whole new level. The growers consider themselves producers of a product with medicinal values that have the potential to help millions of people. Regardless of their noble rhetoric, the driving force in growers' efforts is the potential for profits that are limited only by the size of their crops and their ability to avoid capture. The flip side of the coin is the law enforcement effort to identify, arrest and prosecute the cultivators and marketers of a substance that is legal according to state law, but still a violation of federal law. This conflicting dynamic is the source of varying opinions voiced by the players and chasers alike. As the national debate on marijuana's place in American society heats up, the cast of Weed Country will provide faces and places to associate with the battle. This 6-part series will be followed by Pot Cops in April. Pot Cops will focus on law enforcement efforts to eradicate marijuana in Humboldt County, Ca. Regardless of your opinion of the future of marijuana, Weed Country is an inside look into one of the many issues that pits states' rights against federal law. These days, that's always a battle worth watching. Meanwhile, check out the explosive and provocative trailer below. It will give you some idea of the scope and the stake of what's involved in this controversial issue.
Article number 7, Pot Tourism in Colorado. Take it away, B, for the last story of the day.
Pot Tourism in Colo? Marijuana Regulators Okay Idea. By Kristen Wyatt. Source, Associated Press. Denver AP marijuana tourism is on the way to Colorado, under a recommendation made Tuesday by a state task force to regulate the drug made legal by voters last year. But Colorado should erect signs in airports and borders telling visitors they can't take pot home, the task force recommended. Colorado's Marijuana Task Force was assembled to suggest regulations for pot after voters chose to flout federal drug law and allow its use without a doctor's recommendation. Made up of lawmakers, law enforcement authorities and marijuana activists, the task force agreed Tuesday that the constitutional amendment on marijuana simply says that adults over 21 can use the drug, not just Colorado residents. If lawmakers agree with the recommendation, tourists would be free to buy and smoke marijuana. Imposing a residency requirement would almost certainly create a black market for recreational marijuana in the state, said Republican Dan Pablon, a Denver Democrat who sits on the task force. Tourists could see purchasing caps though, possibly as low as an eighth of an ounce per transaction. Afraid that marijuana tourism could open the door for traffickers to load up and take it across state borders for illegal sale, task force members agreed that non-residents should be able to buy only limited amounts, though a specific amount wasn't set. Marijuana purchased in Colorado must stay in Colorado, Pablon warned. We could attract greater federal scrutiny and displeasure of our neighbors if marijuana flows across state lines, he said. Task force members were less successful agreeing to recommendations on marijuana growing in public use. Colorado's marijuana law allows home growing but requires plants to be in a locked, secure location out of public view. The task force couldn't agree whether a locked and secure location would mean a backyard surrounded by a fence, or whether an enclosure such as a shed or greenhouse should be mandatory. One of the task force's most vocal marijuana critics, Greenwood Village Police Chief John Jackson, worried that backyard pop gardens would need more than a chain-link fence to keep kids out. Not all task force members agreed. User advocate Meg Sanders said the covering requirement wouldn't be fair to rural Coloradans. I think it goes too far in restricting what people can do on their own private property, Sanders said. Public use also prompted a dispute that wasn't resolved Tuesday. Jackson and others wanted to ban marijuana use on publicly visible patios, porches and backyard. Marijuana activists chafed. So I can drink a beer on my porch? But I can't smoke a joint? Asked marijuana advocate Christian Sederberg. State Senator Sherry Jan, D. Wheat Ridge, said lawmakers would hesitate to regulate something legal people do on private property. What about backyard grills that send the smell of hamburgers into the nose of a neighbor who's vegetarian? She asked. I don't know how far we want to go telling people what they can't do on their own porches, she said. The porch marijuana question was left unsettled. Task force members also put off a decision on proposals from Jackson to exempt law enforcement from maintaining marijuana and marijuana plants seized during criminal investigations. Potency and labeling recommendations for commercial marijuana will also be discussed later. The task force has until February 28 to recommend marijuana regulations, which will ultimately be set by the state legislature and the Department of Revenue, the agency which oversees gambling and alcohol and will also regulate recreational pot.
All right, that's all I have for this week. You all have a good day, good night, good week. Till next time. Bye-bye.
We pollinated your minds. Now, go pollinate the world.